Okay, I'm on the northbound actors. Just trying to light.
Look, I think, Carl, what the hell can they do? And I think we can set it up again.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Welcome back, folks. We're now going to work on our third episode about the 51st Street Gang Crips. We have started with when the L.A. Gang Crips and Bloods first arrived in Kansas City and how the locals started taking on those identities and developed their own gangs and identified themselves under the Crips and Bloods
moniker.
The Crips and Bloods overall name, umbrella name, would that be the right term? Umbrella name, and then they would have these out in L.A. They called them sets. Here they just took on their own little gang, the 51st Street Crips, and there was the what was it, Jim? The Triple Deuce Wall or the
Tray Wall?
The Tray Wall gang. That was because the wall all these kids sat on was at 33rd and Chestnut.
Right.
We're back here with my good friend Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
And our special guest, Jim. Can you say hello, Jim?
How are you?
Jim Harrington spent 25 years on the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. And what departments did you work in, Jim? Can you tell people again?
I worked in patrol, like everybody starts out in. Then I went to the tactical response team.
How many years were you on that?
4.5 years.
That's a SWAT team, folks, in Kansas City.
And then I became a detective. I started out in sex crimes. I could only take that for about a year. I worked in robbery for, 4.5 years. Went to homicide for a brief second. And then the career criminal unit got formed, so I
jumped on board for that.
And then when I went back to the homicide unit before I retired.
So how many years were you in career criminal?
7 to 8, somewhere in there.
And that's the time of your career we're talking about, your time in a career criminal.
You say about what years those were?
2001 to 2008.
One of your major investigations and one of your earliest investigations was this gang war between the 51st Street Crip and this Tray Wall gang, correct?
Yes.
Let's talk a little more about, you mentioned you worked with street narcotics and how those people, during the break, we talked about how, I know when I worked in the intelligence unit, we went out on surveillance, we might have 4 or 5 cars. And when you guys, when the career criminal unit went out on a surveillance of a subject, a criminal, you would have 4 or 5 cars. Now, explain how these street narcotics people work.
Well, I think they're crazy because they go out with, sometimes it's just 2 of them out doing a buy. And they're in, they're in the most dangerous parts of the city, dealing with very violent people. It's pretty gutsy to go out and do that every day.
So one of them gets out and approaches a kid selling narcotics on the street.
He's not on the street. She just cold calls him. But Steve Wright is in jail awaiting a homicide case, or a Jackson County's prosecuting on a homicide case.
And Steve Wright, he was kind of the purported leader of the 51st Street Crips at this point in time.
Yes, that's what we thought. And we confirmed it too. He clearly led them. The street narcotics officer is just doing what they do. And she has a tip to call this person. She calls him and sets up sort of a cold case or, a cold buy. She wants to buy some ecstasy from him. And she drops Stevie's name. I don't remember exactly how, but, says she used to buy from Stevie or Stevie recommended or something along that lines.
So she knew this was a 51st Street Crip when she approached him, probably from the tipster that gave her the phone number.
Yes.
Probably told her this is a 51st Street.
Right. And then she just cold calls the guy.
Right. Which is really, That's hard to do to be, you know, you got to be pretty convincing when you do that. But she convinces him. She was good. She convinces him and he starts selling to her. You know, when those sales are going on, we're assisting, but they're still running the investigation.
So you find out about it. Your unit finds out about it.
Right.
And you start moving in and giving her support and backup while she goes out and makes the buys.
Yep. She does a series of buys. It's not just one or two.
Correct.
Is she buying up, trying to buy a little more quantity each time?
You know, I don't know if she was just building cases as far as little, you know, a little bit each time, or she was trying to build up. I don't remember exactly what she was doing, but she was building the number of buys she got. And by this time she, you know, she knew we were looking at them because, you know, they had called and said, this is what they had going. Were we interested in helping them?
And you wanted, there's a certain number of buys will up the penalty in the federal system, because you're going to put this guy in the federal system in order to squeeze him, to get him to roll over on Stevie Wright in the upper echelon of 51st Street Crips, correct?
Yeah, but I've never worked in narcotics, and there is some sort of, there's a game plan they have, but I've never worked there, so I'm not sure exactly what the quantity or number of buys they want.
As you up the quantity and the number of buys, the penalty under the sentencing guidelines goes up. I mean, you could take a young guy and put him in penitentiary for the rest of his life if you get enough quantity off of him and you get enough buys. So anyhow, you're doing this and kind of culminates one night in an interesting phone call.
Right. And I don't remember if she initiates the call or Jamal Norris is the person she was buying from.
He was the street dealer.
Right. He was clearly the dealer for that group. They make a three-way call to Steve Wright, who's in the Jackson County Jail at the time.
Interesting. And how do they do that?
There's a general number for the cell blocks.
No, you're.
Did he have a cell phone? I know they've got cell phones.
I don't know if Stevie called him.
In.
No, it was on a regular line at Jackson County. So it had to have been initiated by Stevie calling Jamal for whatever reason. But eventually they get around to, you know, hey, I'm selling to this girl and, you know, she used your name. And Stevie Wright, I'm probably betting Stevie has Jamal call. Yeah. And then there's a three-way phone call. You're not supposed to have three-way phone calls in the jail because the phone system's supposed to not allow it. But clearly it worked. She's trying to convince Stevie that she knows him or she's bought from him before.
That they've met?
Yeah, and she hasn't. You know, she's just making it up as she goes along.
Well, does she have any case information on him as far as, you know, that, like, you guys have background on him? Would she have access to any of that? Or depending, you know, in the moment of the calls, you might not even be in a location where she could gather something together.
No, she had the information. She would have had information, but basically she's good at her job. And she can just sort of, she's got the gift of gab, I guess some people call it, but she can, you know, she can talk her way into stuff and talk her way out of stuff. But at the end of the phone call, Steve Wright tells Jamal Norris, don't sell to her.
Oh, really?
Jamal Norris can't help himself.
But it does show control by Stevie Wright over the drug dealer.
Yes.
That's a good thing about that. Whether he says sell to her or don't sell to her, it shows that he controls that drug dealer, which then locks him into the conspiracy. Correct?
Right. And he later admitted when I was talking to him that Jamal Norris should have followed his advice. He said no.
But Jamal Norris didn't follow his advice.
And I think it was too late by then anyhow.
It was, and he couldn't help himself. The undercover was convincing, and she
was pretty attractive, too. Maybe that was part of it. I don't know. I've seen her.
That could have been a reason.
But she wasn't. Was she just simply trying to get a case on Jamal Norris, or was it one of these situations where her work was helping you because you were going to use Jamal Norris to put pressure on Stevie Wright?
I think at the time she made the phone call, I'm not sure if that entered her mind, if she would have thought, you know, it would have helped, but clearly it did help. But I don't know if that was her intention going out. I think it was she just answered the phone, knew it was calling, and, you know, she had to answer the phone and come up with a story.
Right. Well, she did good. She did good. She kept buying from him and ended up making cases, and that was probably a big part of making a case on Stevie Wright for controlling that drug operation, I would imagine.
Yeah, that conversation was important.
Yeah.
Well, even though he was in Jackson County, he still had control.
Correct. He was still, you know, and that people thought enough of him to call and say, should I keep doing this? And it wasn't just because she had used his name. It was because he was in control.
Just because you go to jail doesn't mean you're not still acting as a criminal.
Now, it's interesting because that Jamal Norris was in college at the time when he was doing this.
Well, Well, let's talk about their guns. You know, I looked over this paperwork and they had a ton of guns. It was amazing how many really good guns they had. They had these SKS assault rifles. They had, I think there was a Kalashnikov or two in there, and they had a lot of 40 caliber good guns too, Glocks and Smiths and really high quality guns.
Handguns.
Handguns and then the long rifles with the SKS is SKS and Kalashnikov, they both have that same large caliber shell?
I think one's a Chinese version and one's a Russian version.
Russian version, okay. And those things are bad. Those are the baddest guns on the street. That gun will propel a bullet through your bulletproof vest.
Yep.
It will propel a bullet through the tank that we've got. It will propel a armor-piercing round through about anything.
Yep.
So, and they had a ton of them out there. It was just amazing. How did they get all these guns? Did you do much tracing of the guns? I noticed there was one time when you caught a bunch of them at a gun show.
Right.
And, you know, we all know it's easier. Now, I know this is a political hot deal where I'm not making any comments about gun shows or gun laws, but they were at a gun show. And why were they there?
Well, they were looking at guns. So a lot of them are amazed by guns, maybe, or enthralled by them. They're gun enthusiasts, gun nuts, what we would call them. Most of them could not purchase guns.
Most of them were convicted felons.
Right. Or they were too young at the time.
That's true. Most of them were like 18, 17 years old, weren't they?
They would go look at guns because it was probably entertaining for them, but they would take girls with them.
Pick out what they wanted.
Right. And then take girls with them and have the girls go in and, you know, the ATF calls that a straw purchase. Yeah.
Who would be older than them.
And not a felon. But, you know, on the form you fill out, you know, that's one of the questions ATF asks. Are you purchasing this for somebody else? Because they look for that.
Right.
And they would simply answer no and then purchase these guns.
But then when the gun is used in a crime and then you pick it up in a, you know, they'll have a serial and it'll trace it back to this other person. And they don't care?
They don't care. Girls are a dime a dozen to most of them.
No, but they could also, when they go to the gun shows, they could buy other stuff. They could buy ammo.
Sure, you can buy ammo.
They didn't have to. It didn't matter if they were a felon. They wouldn't check just if you were buying rounds and stuff. And they already had guns.
You have to give ID if you're buying ammo.
Yeah, but
at a gun store you do. But
you don't.
You don't at a gun store.
There's no federal check that I know of. You can buy ammunition.
Check.
Yeah. Even though it's just as though you can get the same punishment for felon in possession of a bullet as you will for felon in possession of a gun.
I didn't know that. Interesting. But they did have a lot of guns, and they did use them a lot. Were these guys responsible for any of the, every once in a while we have some the killing of a child that was just caught in a crossfire? Or
sure. When you were talking a couple episodes ago, you talked about, you know, a call coming out and two cars driving down Prospect shooting at each other.
Right.
They weren't very good shots unless the target was stationary. Number one, it's hard for a trained policeman to do that.
Right.
And they were, but oftentimes there were innocent witnesses or innocent bystanders who were, you know, had nothing to do with it that got hit. Fat Tone was thought to be involved in a murder where it was a kid was hit on a porch. And
okay.
One of these shoot back and forth at each other.
Now, this was part of what was making Kansas City the fifth most violent city per capita.
Yes.
Now, when you would go through and they would have this happen, it happened more than once. I mean, there's a police level response, right?
Correct.
That maybe isn't you, but rather, you know, like the local officer, there's been a shooting. It comes in as a report. Somebody has to go there to investigate what's going on, which is probably usually just a uniformed street officer.
Right. And then, you know, if somebody's seriously injured, the detectives are going to show up. As a matter of fact, one of them was, I told you I was in homicide for a short time before I went to career criminal. Well, Alex Clark was killed. Alex Clark was Tommy Simmons' cousin. He was at 33rd and South Benton. And my squad, when I was in homicide, I went to that scene just by chance. And it was Alex Clark was suspected of shooting, killing, or assaulting 51st Street guys. There was clearly, he was not quiet about his actions.
Mm-hmm.
His color, he wore loud colors to announce what gang he was in. He was one of the ones that did it.
He wore red.
Yep. And he's gunned down, and it's a brutal, you know, you couldn't have an open casket with him. It was a brutal, brutal murder. So
was it a drive-by or?
Nope. They walked up on, probably behind him. He had headphones on. They'd walked up behind him and shot him and then continued to shoot him.
And he was the cousin to Tony Simmons, who was the head of the 33rd Street Gang or the Trey Walls.
Yeah, and it's Tommy.
Tommy Simmons.
I'm sorry, Tommy Simmons.
His father had the same name.
I was going to say, there was a when I was a young policeman, about 35th and Woodland to 39th Street, that was my district, 154, there was a Tommy Simmons that was at about 19 or 20 years old, was a career criminal at that point in time.
He was a good burglar.
Yeah, he was a great burglar. I'll be darned. That's Tommy Simmons' kid.
Yep.
I used to stop and mess with him all the time, but he was not violent. These guys back then... They'd burglarize houses, they'd burglarize businesses, they would get credit cards and go out and use them, steal purses, but they weren't shooting each other up at all.
No, he was very intimidating. He was a bigger guy, especially when he got older. He would use that, but no, for the most part, he burglarized nice homes and got nice stuff.
He was a professional burglar. He was part of a little Frankie Dorch's gang, I think, who was the guy out of South Patrol who he was part of that
they
gang,
were,
wasn't he?
They were related. Tommy and the Dorch's are related.
Yeah, they would burglar high-end homes later on. When they were kids like that, they were burglarizing their neighbors' homes over there in the neighborhood. But they graduated on to Mission Hills.
Yep, Mission Hills and Ward Parkway.
Ward Parkway. How many times in my squad that my guys hated me because I like to go out and do surveillances. The attack guys, not attack squad, attack guys, they like to go storm around and stop people and jack with people. I like to focus on particular crimes. And so we'd get a burglary pattern over there in Ward Park between Warnell and State Line along Ward Parkway, and we'd get a burglary pattern. And I'd get plain cars, and you could wear plain clothes, but I'd make them stay in those areas and just cruise those areas just looking for people like Frankie Dorsch and Tommy Simmons. We only caught them one night, but we caught them dead bang one night, so it was all worthwhile. But most of those tack guys hate doing that. They like to go out and rip and run and...
We followed the same people when I was attacked at the same locations for doing the same crimes.
Really? Well, it's job security, isn't it, for the police?
Well, how many times did you catch him? You caught him once?
Yeah.
And then, he goes through the whole arrest, and then they bond out.
Then
they get back on the street, and there's still a court case, and they defer and defer and...
And they had some money people. These guys, this little gang, and we're getting off of our street gang thing, but it's kind of interesting. I was at the courthouse one time. I was working between my second and third year of law school, I was a clerk, an intern for Judge Atwell in Division 10 in Jackson County Circuit Court. So they brought Frankie Dorsch in for, I think it was a bond reduction hearing. They had him on a big-time burglary from out in that neighborhood, because it had to be on the Missouri side. And there was a guy, an older man, sitting. He was the only guy in the courtroom that was sitting out and where the audience would sit. And he was watching. He was studying these proceedings. He wanted to know. It was obvious he wanted to know what happened. And he had, just real tasteful but expensive gold jewelry, just a little bit on, and really expensive, nice clothes. And he was way too interested in what was going to happen to Frankie Dorsch, I thought. I never could figure the deal out. But he was like the fence or kind of the control over these guys that was maybe help set up the scores and then help get rid of the
yeah, that the move that stealing. Stolen merchandise.
Help move. He was like the black Junior Bradley, I had the feeling. It was did that kind of thing, too, but mainly for white guys.
Well, you talked about whether people were fearful of us finding the guns. The police recovered a lot of those guns.
Yeah.
And they matched a lot of these homicides and assaults.
To those guns.
Right. And sometimes they weren't caught carrying them, or there's a group of four of them that had the guns. But they were sloppy, I guess. They didn't get rid of the guns. They kept those guns, and they used them for sometimes multiple crimes.
They weren't like the mob. They didn't throw them away as soon as they got done.
No.
They kept them. And so then you even got some fingerprints off of some of them, I believe, that matched up to some of the 51st Street gang.
Rashawn Long, Steve Wright, both had fingerprints on different guns.
Right.
And then the ballistics would match as well.
Correct.
And the ballistics would match. Oh, I know what I wanted to talk about was the drug ripoffs, in particular the Hispanic guy on the bicycle. That was kind of an interesting one.
Hector Santos, I think, was his name.
Right, that was his name. What do you remember about that?
We had somebody that cooperated and said that they were, I think he said he was there when that happened. And it took some doing to get that information, but eventually, said it was over. I think the term at the time was a bird, which is a kilo. He said they were going to rip off He had bought from Stevie, had purchased from him before. But you know, everybody, it's greed, you know, that drives him, and, you know, probably not buying kilo totals at that point in his life. Mm-hmm. But so he bought and bought. And then, you know, the word is, hey, he's got a kilo in the house. He looks like an easy mark. So they killed him, took some money from him, and then went into his house looking for this kilo, to which I'm not sure they ever, it wasn't, I'm sorry.
Wait a second. Who is the guy they killed?
It wasn't a kilo. It was PCP at the time.
Oh, was it?
They killed Hector Santos. I want to say 41st in Virginia. It was in front of his own house, but they were looking for PCP at the time, I believe is what they're trying to steal from him.
Did they, do you know if they found it?
No, I don't know if, it became hectic, I think, afterwards. And I'm not,
their drug operation was not that organized. Sound like they didn't have a good solid business, a business model, a business plan where they had a good solid connection coming in once a month or.
Right. If they did, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't kilo type stuff. Okay. Jamal Norris must've had a pretty good connection, but it seemed to be, they were having to rip people off, do a couple deals with them and then rip them off for the dope and then go find somebody else they could purchase from a couple times and then to rob them.
Probably, it was probably kind of scary to go back after these guys if they ripped you off. If they didn't kill you, just felt lucky they didn't kill you, more than likely.
Right. They ripped off another Hispanic drug dealer and they didn't kill him. And it was, you know, it was difficult to get him to cooperate with us. And it wasn't just the fact that he had to say he was selling dope, because we knew he was doing that and he'd already had a conviction for it. It was, you know, he was afraid. He was generally fearful that they would come back to get him.
Well, then he knew it had happened to Hector. At that point, what had happened to Hector Santos had already happened.
I don't remember the order of those two things, but I don't know if anybody
tied them together.
Right. I'm not sure that, you know, there's a lot of places to buy dope
level.
From.
Yeah. On the street level, you might not tie something like that together. Police would, but on the street level, you may or may not, probably not, actually. It's a big city in a way.
But these guys like Jamal Norris, no one ever ripped them off?
Not that I know of.
You know, it sounds like, I mean, these 51st Street Gang Crips, they just were wild and crazy and were really run rampant over other criminals, citizens, other gangs, and were just, it's kind of like when you got nothing to lose. You know, if you can't scare a guy with going to jail for 40 or 50 years, or maybe even getting the gas chamber, and now it's the needle, I guess they call it. When that doesn't scare you, it's kind of hard to deal with that.
Right. They're not afraid of us.
They're not afraid of the police. They're not afraid of law enforcement. They're not really, you have to keep poking at some of those guys to get somebody to turn, to even find somebody that's afraid of the 30 or 40 years they might get in the federal system for dealing cocaine.
Right.
Eventually you were finding them though, it sounds like.
We did.
What happened with these guys at the end? Is it I noticed there's a large indictment they were talking about here on Jim Harrington served a federal warrant on Wright's apartment at 11210 South Oak, seizing $10,000 in cash. Was that, and then you had a conspiracy indictment naming him, a federal conspiracy indictment naming him as a leader of the 51st Street Crips and Jamal Norris as his top dealer?
Yep.
So he was making a little bit of money. He had $10,000 in cash, but it doesn't sound like they weren't. I had a dope dealer one time talk to me about how he had, he said, what would you think if you knew where there was an apartment? Every room in that apartment was almost filled to the ceiling with cash. And I just knew that he had one, or he knew about one, because he was that kind of guy. But these guys didn't have that kind of money.
No, they're spending it as quickly as they can get. They're not putting money in an IRA for when they're 65. Right. They're spending it. They're buying wheels. They're buying cars. They're buying guns off the street. They're doing dope themselves.
Doing,
you know,
dope. When they're not stealing cars and stealing guns and stealing dope, it was, yeah.
So then what was the indictment against Stephen Wright?
It was for about every kind of narcotics you could sell. PCP, marijuana, crack cocaine, I think probably regular cocaine, several murders committed during, you know, in the act of selling drugs or to support your business, which is how the feds could get involved in, you know, murder. They just can't get involved for your average run-of-the-mill murder.
Right. Was it a RICO case or?
Nope. They did it, a narcotics conspiracy involving murder. So the murder happened as a result of the conspiracy.
As a result of the narcotics conspiracy, and then they didn't do RICO on it.
And then all the gun charges that you stack up
So how did you make him on the murders? Was that from witnesses and ballistics?
But we had witnesses. We had ballistics on some of them.
Okay.
But a lot of it was based on witnesses. And, you know, and witnesses are, that's tough when you have a witness like that, because you have to corroborate, you know, you have to defend them as much as you support them.
Yeah, because they're going to have a checkered history.
Right. And they could have, you know, some people may have a reason to lie to you. So you have to follow that up with, you know, it's great if you have an undercover detective that's got recorded phone calls into them. Those are easy.
You only have a few of those.
Right. But when you have witnesses, you know, you have to, and sometimes you have to decide, we're not using that witness. We don't have anything to prove them correct outside of that. And you can't, you know, you're not going to get conviction.
If the witness gets discredited, it's not going to help your case.
Correct.
You're better off not using them than to use one.
And it could it looks like you're stretching or you're trying to get something that's not true.
Did you have people who went in the witness protection program, or did they deem it that important that they?
We had one that went into witness protection, and he didn't like it, and he's in prison. He didn't like it, and he left. So he's back out in
general population.
The witness protection was prison,
right? There's witness protection in prison. So there's not all the witnesses are. The government's not just going to let you go based upon what you did, especially if you've got a conviction. He had a state conviction for a homicide. Well, they couldn't do anything to protect him in Missouri, but the feds took him into the federal system, and, you know, it's still controlled by the state, his parole and all that, but he was inside a federal prison.
But he was doing his Missouri
time. He was doing his Missouri time in a federal prison, he didn't like it.
But he didn't like the
right. But that was to keep him away from being in the local Missouri prison where his acting as a snitch was going to get him some stitches.
Correct. He was going to get him killed.
Get him killed, right.
Did you ever have that happen where you had somebody in like that, where you were bringing them in, if you will, to use them as a witness, and it was they were assaulted or they ended up being murdered or anything?
We didn't have when in the Rashawn Long's case after he killed his victim.
And Rashawn Long, let's explain him. He was kind of the enforcer for Stevie Wright and the 51st Street Gang. He was a guy, if you had somebody you wanted to hit, then he was the guy that you sent out.
Right. And by his own admission, he says he's killed 24. And I think he told somebody, you're going to be the 24th or you're going to be the 25th murder. So by his own admission, he's done it. And he gave an interview in The Pitch where he says, you know, it's a rush. You know, when you sell dope or you rob places or you kill people, it's a rush.
I guess so.
But he was at the time when we started investigating him, he was Jackson County already had him tied up on the murder of Michael Burks that happened in February of 01. So he really he didn't become involved in our case because he was already being adjudicated by Jackson County.
So was Burks he one of the Blood Gang members from?
I'm not sure if he was in a gang.
33 Wall.
I don't think he was. It just happened to happen at 30th and Chestnut. But that was another drug ripoff.
Okay. Well, these guys are pretty violent.
We're safer with them in prison.
So Rashawn Long, he's currently serving time?
Yeah, he just got the case that the news article was about that Gary mentioned. I had testified about my knowledge of the Michael Burks homicide, and then he actually shot a witness to that crime in Overland Park. He paralyzed the witness to try to keep him from
testifying.
Because this witness is not, at least in my connection with him, is not the kind of guy that's going to try to get even, but I think they're worried about him talking to the police.
And Stephen Wright?
Stevie is serving at least one life sentence in the federal system, and I think 110 more years on top of that.
So a life sentence, though, is it 23 or 24 years?
No, in the state of Missouri, a life sentence is not that, but in the federal system, a life sentence is a life sentence.
Yeah, you used to have to, I think, like about 85 or 90% of your time.
Right, but with that,
With
life, he won't ever get out. You know, barring some sort of legal action, he's in prison for the rest of his life. And then 110 more years after that.
And right. Jamal Norris?
I think Jamal took a 10-year, I think he got sentenced to 10 years in prison.
Yeah, and in the federal system, again, he'll do 9 or so. Right.
He's probably out.
And, so when that was, 2006? You're talking about time frame when these guys were all kind of popped.
Yeah, but we had him in jail awaiting trial from 2002. So that time that he was awaiting trial, that would
count.
He gets credit for that.
So he's probably out. He should be back out again. Is that or he's dead?
And what about the guys, Tommy Simmons, from the Treywall gang?
He was murdered years later at 70 or at Gregory and Wabash after Tommy went to prison for a little while too.
After he came back out.
Yep.
And he was murdered. Nobody, was that murder ever solved?
It was my squad's case when I was in murder this last time. And to my knowledge, it hasn't been solved. It could have happened since 2012 when I retired, but
was he just standing out there on the street corner and somebody drove by or
no, he left his house. I suspect somebody followed him from where he got killed. There, he's driving in a car, and somebody pulls up next to him on Gregory and shoots him.
He was set up. Yeah, they were watching.
They were just waiting. How long had he been out at that point? Do you know?
I don't remember.
He probably hadn't been out very long at the point that then that happened.
No, he might have been out for a year or so, but it wasn't. It's not like it was 5 years or anything like that.
But was he still really like the head of the 33rd Street Gang then, even though he was incarcerated?
Him not so much as Stevie Wright was when he was incarcerated. They're the 33rd Street guys.
They didn't seem as organized. What I read about them, they weren't as quite as tight an organization.
And the Treywall guys lost the war battle. I mean, they lost that battle. Stevie's group was killing a lot more of Tommy's group than vice versa.
Did they have to quit hanging around the Treywall?
They should have.
Kind of easy place to find them, wasn't it?
Yep.
All right. Well, let's get out of here. Jim, I really appreciate you coming in and talking with us about this. It's very interesting and entertaining. They're horrible things, but, you know, I'm sorry, folks. I can't be politically correct about this. To me, it was always entertaining. It was a great way to earn a living. I was like a little boy who grew up to play cops and robbers for real. Do you feel like that, Jim?
Absolutely.
If you have a friend or a relative, mother or sister, a father or brother, son, grandchild of any kind who has a problem with addiction, drugs, and sometimes you can be addicted to gambling or sex and any kind of compulsive behavior that causes you problems in your personal life, you want to help them out, make your first call the first call. 861-361-5900. First call can do an evaluation. They have a special program called How to Cope that's just for loved ones and relatives of people with addiction problems. FirstCallKC.org.
Remember to download the Gangland Wire Crime Stories podcast episodes with over 35 available at ganglandwire.com. Give us a like, give us a follow on the iTunes, and give us a review. If you're in the United States and you give us a review, Gary will send you maybe a copy of his documentary movie, Gangland Wire. All right.
All right. Good night, Aaron. Good night, Jim. Good night.
Music for Gangland Wire Crime Stories provided by Odd-O-Matic. Check them out online at oddomaticmusic.com.